My pleasure to introduce Vicki Kessler from McGill. I've known Vicki for a few months in the context of the Chime FRD project. She's been a leader for many years, mainly on the topics of neutron stars and pulsars. Presenting a complete list of all of her accolades would use all the time, and she wouldn't be able to speak, so I've just narrowed it down to five. She's the Hertzberg Medal in 2004, the Stiesse Prize in 2006, the Rutherford Medal in 2007, the Prix Marie Victorin in 2009, and recently the Killam Prize in 2015. You get the idea. Most prestigiously of all, she's giving the Perimeter Institute public lecture tonight. So if you're around at 7 o'clock, you can watch it later. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. And happy to get to tell you about radio pulsars and fast radio transients or fast radio bursts, a new phenomenon that we've been very excited about in the, I guess, not just the neutron star community and the radio astronomy community in general. And here's an overview of what I'm hoping to tell you about. I'm going to give you a radio pulsar primer, and I'd really like it if you have questions, just shout them out. Maybe you do anyway. I don't know what the culture here is like. Feel free to just shout them out, because, you know, I'm an astrophysicist. I'm an observational astrophysicist. I go to telescopes and collect data and stuff like that. And so if I say something that you're not familiar with, you'd like to know more about, stop me. I don't have to get through the whole talk. I'm very happy to have a more interactive style thing. The big question that I want to answer for you is, why do people like me and some of my colleagues spend so much time and effort on searching for radio pulsars? Why do we spend not just time and effort, but huge amounts of computing on doing this project? And I should say pulsars, and I should have added fast radio transients, because that's the hot new thing we're really excited by. And then, so I'm going to answer that question. I'm going to motivate it scientifically for you. Both in principle and with some specific examples of recent discoveries we've made that keep us at this. I'll describe to you how to find pulsars, how we go about doing this, and then describe to you some of the current big pulsar surveys, the P-Alpha and the GBNCC surveys. And as I said, I'll describe to you some of the highlights. I don't know if I'll have time, depending on you. If you don't ask anything, I'll probably get through all the highlights. I can just keep talking. Or maybe I'll skip some, and we can talk in depth about others. And then at the end, I want to tell you about the Chime telescope, which is a very exciting Canadian radio telescope that's being built and that will be fantastic for radio pulsar and transient science. So just to make sure we're all on the same page, I'm talking about radio pulsars, which are a form of neutron star, which is one of the endpoints of stellar evolution. So this is, it's kind of dim. Like, can you all see this? Is this all... Is it just me? Maybe it's my angle, I don't know. But I'm happy if you're happy, so just suggesting, throwing it out there. I also don't want you all to fall asleep, so if you don't, you know, whatever. So the idea is, of course, that, you know, this is maybe that's a little better for you. This is a sort of cartoon where, you know, on the one hand, you have average solar mass type stars, a few solar masses. Those eventually expand to red giants, form planetary nebulae, and eventually end up as white dwarfs. Whereas more massive stars, and here I'm talking about stars more massive than something like 8 times the mass of the sun, 8 solar masses, those will also go through a red giant or supergiant phase and will typically explode in a supernova once they've used up all of the nuclear fuel that keeps them supported against against gravity. And in that case, there's two possible outcomes. We think, and this is now I'm quoting undergraduate textbooks on the subject, not the final authorities, what I'm saying. We think, you know, massive stars between 8 and 20 solar masses produce neutron stars, and above 20 solar masses, black holes. But where that cut actually is not really well known. And in fact, we have lots of observational evidence, which I'd be happy to describe to you in a different talk or afterward, that you can have neutron stars being formed out of very massive stars, 40 solar masses and above. Very interesting topic there, but not one I'm going to get into any more today.
So how about the reverse? Could we get black holes from a smaller star somewhere? Like, 10-dollar mattress star or?
Could you get, so in principle, no. So if you have a 10 solar mass star, so you have to ask, okay, 10 solar masses at what point? So on the, if it's a young star, very young, just formed and is now burning hydrogen, typically they'll blow off some of their mass in the form of a wind. And so by the time they evolve to the point where their cores have formed iron and are ready to implode, so you have to ask, okay, what's the core mass? So it's a little more complicated. So then also exactly how much wind they blow off in their main sequence lifetime depends on what the composition is of the stellar atmospheres. So it's complicated. 10 solar masses is not typically thought to make a black hole. That's pretty strongly neutron star range. When you get into the more massive stars, that's where the ambiguity can arise depending on stellar evolution.
Question?
Yeah.
What range of black hole masses do you expect from current understanding? The black hole star just above the neutron star, or is there a gap before you start to see, expect to see black holes?
Yeah, so that's exactly what I'm saying is that's really not that well understood. So it depends on the evolution of the star. So you're asking exactly at what mass main sequence star would we get a black hole? Is that what you're asking?
Well, no, but once, if you start off with, say, a 40 solar mass young star, it blows off some stuff in its lifetime, then supernovas.
Yeah.
There still will be over the Chandra's, the neutron star upper mass limit, so it will become a black hole.
Right.
But you expect to start seeing black holes at 3-4 solar masses.
Right.
You expect there to be a gap from the heaviest neutron stars to where you start to see the masses of the black holes.
Right. So I'm going to answer it observationally. The most massive neutron stars I'll describe is 2 solar masses right now.
Right. That's where the upper mass limit is.
That's, yeah, yes, but what the true upper limit in nature is depends on the equation of state of dense matter inside the neutron star, and that we don't know. So there's many possibilities. I think somewhere in the talk I show one of those plots. Okay, so now I'm concentrating on neutron stars. And one form of neutron star, not the only form of neutron star, but the most easily observed and by far the most common, at least of the population of neutron stars that we know, this is the most common, is the radio pulsar. And these are rapidly rotating, highly magnetized neutron stars. When I say rapidly rotating, I'm going to talk about all this shortly, but somewhere between a millisecond and a few, maybe tens of seconds, 10 seconds. And magnetic fields on the surface of, typically 10 to the 12 Gauss, but can be as high as several by 10 to the 15 Gauss. Today, we know of about 2,400 of these objects, nearly all of which are in our own Milky Way galaxy. We know of a dozen, maybe two dozen in the Magellanic Clouds, and that's it. They tend to be fairly weak radio sources. And although if you took the most luminous radio pulsar in our own galaxy and put it in the next nearest large galaxy, which is Andromeda Galaxy, we could detect it. It's a challenge to find it. So you'd need to know more about it before you could actually detect it. They emit, I talk about them as radio pulsars, but in fact they emit across the electromagnetic spectrum. There's probably something like 100, 150 that are detected in X-rays. And a comparable number that are detected in gamma rays. They're very weak optical sources, so there's maybe a dozen that are detected optically. But they're generally most easily observed in the radio band. And this is thanks to this process in which we believe the beams of radio waves are produced above the magnetic poles. And we see the pulsar effect if the magnetic pole is misaligned from the rotation axis. There could be pulsars that we will never recognize as pulsars because there's alignment and you just can't see it. And certainly you can see that there's many pulsars in the galaxy we will never be able to detect because their beams don't intersect our line of sight. And of course, neutron stars are small objects, typically 20 kilometers across. And so we don't actually ever resolve a picture like that. What we really detect is only intensity variations in the power output of a radio telescope. And this is what some real radio pulsar data from a radio telescope look like? A succession series of pulses, not all of them the same. There's weather in the pulsar magnetosphere that changes things. And in fact, this isn't really typical at all. This is an incredibly bright radio pulsar. Most often, most of the pulses are comparable to the height of the noise. Maybe occasionally you see a really large pulse. And there's a whole class of other interesting neutron stars that sort of are like radio pulsars. We call them rotating radio transients, or RATs. And that's because for some reason that is not understood, we just see occasionally one of these pulses, and then nothing for hours to days, and then one pulse. And then maybe another one a few minutes later, and then nothing for, again, hours to days. So those are transients. We think that it's the same sort of object. We think it's also a neutron star, but we don't really understand why they're so sporadic. OK, so you probably, you know a lot of this. Neutron stars, roughly 1.4 solar masses, but they go up to 2 solar masses. And I think the least massive one is around 1.2 solar masses. The typical neutron star radius, we think, is around 10 kilometers. The observational handle on that is not quite as good as it is on the masses. We can measure masses with great precision, as I'll describe. Radii is harder to measure. And the typical pulsar magnetic fields are between 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 13 Gauss. But as I said, the really strongly magnetized ones, we call those the magnetars. And I would love to talk. I do tons of work on magnetars. I won't talk to you at all about that today, but if any of you is curious, those are really spectacular objects that produce X-ray and gamma ray bursts, all sorts of fun things. And that's 10 to the, those are about 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 Gauss. The typical pulsar spin periods are between 50 milliseconds and 2 seconds, but there's a class of really fast rotators called the millisecond pulsars, and I'm going to talk a lot about those. That rotate at a few milliseconds. That's several hundred hertz. And the fastest one we know of rotates 716 hertz. And that's what we call a millisecond pulsar. And there's the picture is just if you brought a neutron star to the island of Montreal where McGill, and there's McGill, just to set the scale. So why are these so interesting? They embody extremes of gravity with gravitational redshifts of 0.3. Great densities, where we believe the density inside the neutron star is upwards of 10 times nuclear density. Extremes, the largest magnetic fields we know of in the universe, and as extremes of dynamics, we often find these systems in binary orbits that are highly relativistic. So orbital periods are just a few hours, and so you have these great extremes, and yet they're observable. And so, in this sense, you could think of it as a physics dream come true. But the extremes don't end there because they also represent extremes of precision. So some of these pulsars, and by no means all, in fact, one of the points of searching for lots of these is to be able to pick out the jewels that are going to be really good for precision tests of general relativity, for example. Some of these pulsars have extremely stable rotational periods. And so this is actually not the most stable one. This one is known to be a little bit noisy. But there is its pulse period as measured on this particular modified Julian day. And the uncertainty is in the last digit, and it's in parentheses. So in some cases, we can measure pulsar periods to a part in 10 to the 15 on long timescales. And this is by keeping track of every pulse count, doing phase coherent timing. And pulsar timing is a wonderful topic that actually is intimately involved with what I'm describing. I won't go into too much detail on exactly how we measure those numbers. Rather, I wanted to focus on finding them. How do we go about finding them? Oh, yeah. And so pulsars can be, if you think about them as the pulses as ticks of a clock, they're comparable to the best atomic time standards. And so, of course, we can find pulsars in binary systems where the pulse period is changing due to the Doppler effect as it moves toward and away from you. You get only the radial component of the orbital velocity in the Doppler shift. But because there are such precise clocks, you can study the dynamics with exquisite precision. And of course, there's Nobel-celebrated experiments in relativistic gravity. And just to give you some examples, Here I've plotted pulse period versus time, and you can see data points with error bars. And if you have an eagle eye, you see actually the student didn't do a perfect fit to the data. They should have lengthened the orbital period a little bit. But anyways, you get the idea for the precisions that we're talking about. When the pulsar is in a binary, it's really obvious. I mean, you just.
What fraction of them is in a binary?
What's that?
From the ones you've observed, what fraction?
What fraction are in binaries? Yeah. So of 2,400, I would say 100, about 150 are in binaries.
I see. And both of them usually the system is like two neutron stars or like starting.
Right. So, no, a small fraction of those are double neutron star binaries. So of the double neutron star binaries, there's, you know, a dozen maybe, something like that. The vast majority are neutron star white dwarf binaries. So, and there's astrophysical reasons why that's true that I'm going to explain. One binary that is predicted from binary evolution models to exist is a neutron star black hole binary. And that has, we have not yet found a radio pulsar black hole binary. There is possible selection bias against finding them, which I could explain, but we're still looking. And the prediction is that in the latest stellar evolution models that you should find one for every 2,000 radio pulsars. So we're at 2,400. So, you know, it's like second line in every proposal that we write, you're gonna find that black hole binary, but we haven't yet. And so you see this is a circular orbit because it's a nice sine wave. This is an eccentric orbit. Again, the data points with error bars shown are on the plot. And so, you know, when it's eccentric, it's very obvious. And I'm putting this plot on because I'm hiding the details of pulsar timing for the purposes of this talk. But I'm giving you the impression from these plots that this is actually how we do the detailed timing. And for example, test general relativity by fitting this curves to the data that the period is versus time, and that's actually not true. This is how we initially solve orbits, determine roughly what the system is. Then, when we want to do the really precise stuff, we start doing the pulse counting, phase coherent timing, where we keep track of the pulse phase unambiguously for many years, and then we fit models to the pulse. Phases or the pulse times of arrival, as we call it. But this is a much simpler pictorial way to view pulsar timing, and that's what I'm showing you. Okay, so just to talk a little bit about where pulsars come from, and in particular the millisecond pulsars. So the fastest spinning pulsars, we do not believe were born spinning that fast. Millisecond pulsars, the several hundreds of rotations per second pulsars, we think are recycled, meaning that they accreted matter from a binary companion in an earlier phase of their evolution called the X-ray binary phase. So the picture is that you typically have, so not typically, you know, the neutron stars are formed in these supernova explosions of a massive star, that's where they're born. And most massive stars are in binary systems, but the supernova almost always breaks apart the binary. So it's really the lucky neutron stars that keep their companion. And it's those that will eventually turn into, a fraction of those will eventually turn into the millisecond pulsars. And those are the ones we really love to find because they're really good for precision studies. And so the lucky neutron stars that kept their binary companion, eventually binary companion most often turns into a white dwarf. Most of the companions will turn into white dwarfs. And if the stars are close enough, you will get accretion either during the white dwarf phase or even prior to the white dwarf forming. You can have it in both cases. But matter gets transferred via an accretion disk onto the neutron star, and the process releasing huge amounts of gravitational potential energy in the form of X-rays. And we see dozens of these X-ray binaries around the sky with X-ray telescopes. And what happens is the neutron star can be spun up. So it accretes matter and angular momentum at the same time. And that's what spins them up to these millisecond periods. And so what makes a millisecond pulsar, and I'm mentioning this because this is, you know, this is sort of I shouldn't say undergraduate textbook on it. Now we're in the graduate textbook regime. But I'm about to show you examples which falsify this, but argue, you know, some of the interesting things we found don't agree with this standard model for the production of binary pulsars. So what makes a millisecond pulsar an MSP? You start out with a binary system, and we call them initially more massive star the primary, and it's the one that so the more massive star evolves first. There's astrophysical reasons for that, that one evolves first, and in this case it goes woomph into a supernova and produces a neutron star. And in if that binary then disrupts at, this thing doesn't really work. Yeah, so if that binary disrupts, you end up with a young pulsar and a runaway other star, and that's it. But if the binary survives, you can have a radio pulsar here that has not yet accreted any matter. That's a young radio pulsar. And the massive star is still in a binary. Eventually, this star starts to go into its giant phase, dumps matter onto the neutron star, produces X-ray binary. And then you have another possible outcome. One is if this is not too massive and it loses a lot of its mass, it will leave behind this spun-up, recycled millisecond pulsar, and then a white dwarf. And so, in the process of transferring this matter, we believe all of those orbits tend to circularize. So this is the most common way to produce the binary pulsar: is you end up with a recycled millisecond pulsar, like really fast spinning, and a white dwarf in a circular orbit. That's the most common. But if you have a higher mass star and it doesn't lose too much mass, then it will go woomph in its supernova, and probably that will get disrupted, and then you'll have a young pulsar which just formed, and the mildly recycled pulsar go zip off. Or if the binary survives, that's when you get your double neutron star binary. So that's why it's rarer, because that's a survive two binary, two supernovae. And there's a lot of information I've just given you. But if you've digested that, understood it, then it might be clear now why it's hard to find, why it's harder to find black hole pulsar binaries, and that's because the black hole evolves first. Black hole is initially the most massive star, and so it forms a black hole with a neutron star progenitor. So the picture is different here. And I guess actually there's one fact that I forgot to mention is that the neutron star, when it gets recycled, its magnetic field is also quenched. In that process, then it lives much longer as a radio pulsar. With a lower magnetic field, lives much longer as a radio pulsar. So the point is that a black hole pulsar binary will only ever form with a non-recycled pulsar, which doesn't live that long. And so you just don't have as much time to observe it in the galaxy. The pulsar will eventually stop pulsing. But anyway, that's sort of a side point, just since you're interested in black holes. Yes?
So do we see MSPs in binaries?
Yes. So almost all MSPs are in binaries.
Okay.
Yeah, with white dwarfs. But you raise an interesting point, because there are some isolated MSPs. And so you might say, well, where do they come from? It's a small fraction. And we think, in some cases, the MSP, because it has a relativistic wind that's quite powerful, can whittle away the companion. And so given a billion years, and these things last for many billions of years, it's in principle possible to evaporate the companion. So that's a leading theory why we see some single millisecond pulsars.
Yeah. By the same kind of reasoning, can people estimate how common a black hole binary should be?
So absolutely. So you can do that estimate, and it should be much less common. So as I said, something like one in every 2,000 radio pulsars, you will end up with a black hole pulsar binary. But the question is, there's a question of how often they form, but also how long they'll live to be observed, how long they're observable for, because radio pulsars don't live forever. Or in other words, the radio pulsar emission mechanism turns off after typically a few million years, unless the pulsar gets recycled.
Right, but the same reasoning about disruption. So if you had two very massive stars both going to black holes, the strong likelihood is that they would be disrupted and separate. Can you draw that conclusion?
Well, so
that seeing a pair of black holes bound closely together is rare?
So I don't know exactly what you call rare. Yes, so it's unusual.
Right.
Yes, the typically binaries get disrupted. That's right. So the rule of thumb is that if less than half the mass in the system is lost, then the binary stays bound. That's the so if you have a really massive star turning into a black hole and most of the mass stays in the binary, then at least nominally that binary should stay bound.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this also has to do with the physics of supernova. Some supernova are asymmetric. That changes that equation a little bit. So you can have kicks in supernovae which are more likely to disrupt the binary or sometimes keep it bound even if more than half the mass is lost. It's actually a really interesting field to try and estimate these kind of things. But it, generally speaking, it gets disrupted and it's the rare case that stays bound. But anyway, the main point I wanted to make here so that I can later disprove it is, so pulsars are recycled. Once they're recycled, they live essentially forever, Hubble time. They don't turn off, their magnetic field is quenched, and there's nothing really, there's nothing to spin it down. It just stays pretty much the same forever. And these systems, these millisecond white dwarf binaries, are distributed because it's an old population of the galaxy. It's roughly fairly isotropic in the galaxy, or at least as far as we can see, and that has been the standard lore. And you typically will find them all over the sky in circular binaries with degenerate companions, a white dwarf companion. It's a very old system. And there's also a predicted evolutionary relationship between an X-ray binary, we call this a low-mass X-ray binary, and millisecond pulsars. Okay. So just, again, motivating pulsars as laboratories. As I said, the densities are in the centers of neutron stars are very high, and so there's questions about the equations of state, which we can address by finding more pulsars because we can measure masses of pulsars thanks to modeling binary dynamics. We can measure masses with great precision. The maximum mass teaches us about the equation of state, and in addition, the maximal rotation speed, it also teaches us about the equation of state. Every equation of state for some mass will predict a maximum rotation rate beyond which the star should fall apart. So finding ever faster pulsars is constraining. And so here is a plot. So this is just showing, you know, we know a lot about the structure of the exterior of the neutron star. We think we understand how it transitions from normal matter at the crust to neutron-rich matter as you go into the inner crust, and so on and so forth. All sorts of interesting physics going on in here. But the point is that, you know, the proposals we write are all about that question mark, which is what's going on at the center. And there's many different models. This is a mass radius diagram for neutron stars, where all the different lines are different models for the equation of state. And what you can see is, for example, the constraint that the maximal rotation rate, so the fastest spinning pulsar, the 716 hertz pulsar, places, and it's not very constraining right now. As you increase the rotation rate, that line goes up that way. And there's also the constraints placed by measurements of mass. And you can see the current best, it's actually not the best, well, it's close to the best one. I'm going to show you one that's equivalent, 1614. That's very well measured mass. The thickness of that red line indicates uncertainty. And you can see it's beyond the maximal masses predicted for many equations of state, but not all. So it doesn't determine the equation of state. But that's the game. We want to try and find more pulsars and pick out the jewels. Some of them are boring. We find lots of pulsars. Some are dull. But others, we found a binary relativistic orbit. Great, let's measure masses. And so in some cases, we find them in very relativistic binaries. And we can do, you know, famed dynamical tests by measuring post-Keplerian parameters. And then there's all the binary evolution astrophysics that we learn by observing lots of these systems. And then, of course, as the connections between the topics here, it's interesting from a binary evolution point of view to find a pulsar black hole binary, but it's also interesting dynamically, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, there's the other reason that we're all very excited to find pulsars, because they can be detectors of gravitational waves. And the idea is because we're harnessing the precision of the joules of the population to create a pulsar timing array where we're hoping to detect gravitational waves, in this case with frequencies in the nanohertz regime, using millisecond pulsars distributed isotropically on the sky and observed over many years regularly. To do this experiment, you need many of these millisecond pulsars. And in fact, I'm going to skip this because I think you probably know this, but I'll just show you. This is a plot just showing the complementarity of the pulsar timing array as a pulsar, as a gravitational wave detector with, for example, LIGO, which is a ground-based gravitational wave detector. This is frequency on this axis. You see, we're in the nanohertz regime. These are very long period gravitational waves that we're hoping to detect. And there's predictions for the sorts of signals we might see, possibly cosmic strings, possibly merging supermassive black holes. And those swaths here are the range of the predictions, probably not completely up to date. And these are the sorts of sensitivity curves that we have. And up till now, we have not detected them. But the point that I want to make is that we want more millisecond pulsars for the following reason. This is a plot showing the significance of detection as a function of the gravitational wave amplitude. And if you look, for example, at the black curve here, this is the sort of significance that you expect from timing a pulsar timing array with 20 pulsars for 5 years. OK, so if you have 20 pulsars distributed on the, isotropically in the sky, that's the sort of sensitivity you can hope to get. So it's not that sensitive. But then if you up it to the next one with the little crosses, that is if you do it for 10 years. And then, of course, for 20 years, you do better. But then the red lines are showing you if you had 50 pulsars. So what you could see is that the significance of detection for any, for gravitational wave amplitudes, generally speaking, is much higher for more when you add it by adding more pulsars versus by timing them for longer. In other words, you win big by finding millisecond pulsars sooner and then timing for a long time. Yeah.
When the wave passes through the position of the pulsar, or also if there's a wave somewhere between the pulsar and us?
So really what you're measuring is the Earth terms. We don't know the distances to the pulsar, so what we're measuring is the effective delay in pulse arrival times. So it's not the, we don't actually, I guess you could think of it as the frequency changing, but we're detecting changes in arrival times due to the gravitational waves. And you expect to see it in a correlated way across the sky also. So there's correlations between different directions of pulsars. So you expect some pulsars to behave one way, other pulsars to behave a different way. So that's for a stochastic background. So you win big by finding more pulsars. So how do we find pulsars? And this is what I spend a lot of my time doing, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about it. We define a survey area, and then we do some survey area into maybe the galactic plane. That's where most pulsars sit. If you want millisecond pulsars, you probably want to move out of the plane. But we choose some area, and then we do systematic pointings with a big radio telescope. And you need really big dishes for this. And for each pointing, you record fast sampled data that has very high radio frequency resolution. So you want very large bandwidths. You want to pulsars emit broadband across the whole radio spectrum. So you'd like to increase your sensitivity, you want large bandwidths. And you do this fast sampled, obviously, because you're looking for short pulses. You spend a huge amount of time doing radio frequency interference removal, because everybody has a cell phone these days, and there's satellites everywhere. And there's a million other sources of radio interference. And you wouldn't believe how much time my students and I spend worrying about this. And then you have to do dispersal. What I say is many trial dispersion measures, and I'll explain that. In fact, I think I explained that now. Yeah, so dispersion measure. This is a big source of the computing, the need for supercomputers in these kind of projects. But basically, the interstellar plasma, the ionized component of the interstellar medium, disperses radio waves in a 1 over frequency squared law. It's called plasma dispersion, where you're way above the plasma frequency, which is, you know, so here, for example, in this observation, where we're observing, this was done at the Parkes Radio Telescope, with the receiver sensitive to frequencies between 400 and 450 megahertz, you can see that the pulses wrap around. So the high frequency pulse the high frequency end arrives first, and then the lower frequency is delayed relative to the high frequency. And in fact, the delay is so much in this case that it wraps around many times, so it's many periods. And this is the result if you sum all those data correcting for those delays. And obviously, if you didn't correct for that and you just summed up all those data, the pulse would be totally washed out. And this is actually a slow pulsar. But for millisecond pulsars, the effect is huge. You absolutely have to correct for the fact that the high radio frequencies are coming in before the low radio frequencies. Otherwise, you don't detect a signal. And the problem is that you don't know in advance how much it's going to be. So effectively, you know, the slope here is an unknown. You have to search over that. And that's called the dispersion measure, which is basically the integrated electron density along the line of sight. And so this is, so on the one hand, that's a pain for us. It's annoying because you don't know in advance and you have to search over it. So you don't know the period in advance. You don't know the dispersion measure in advance. But on the other hand, once you've got the signal and you have the dispersion measure, you have a handle on the distance to the source. Because pulsars are not standard candles by any means. The intrinsic luminosities vary over many orders of magnitude. And so otherwise, you wouldn't know the distances. This would be very hard, except for the closest ones for which you can measure a parallax or something. Or if the pulsar is associated with a supernova remnant, and you have an independent distance estimate. But for the vast majority, you wouldn't have any distance. And this is quite useful. And this is a map of looking down on the galaxy where we are, that little circle there. This is dead. I'm just going to take the hockey stick. I've never done it with hockey. This is exciting. That's us. This is the galactic center. And these are contours of constant dispersion measure. These dark lines are models of the spiral arms. And so you can see if your pulsar has a dispersion measure of 200 and you know in what direction to look, it tells you roughly what the distance is. And so it's a nice model, which is, you know, good typically to 50% for pulsar distances. And so another aspect of this is because you want to find pulsars in binary systems. So you don't know the period, you don't know the DM, but also for the exciting ones, the really good ones for doing interesting tests, you don't know the binary orbital period. And the most relativistic ones, the orbital period can be, you know, not that different from your integration time. And so the pulse period actually changes during your integration. This is like, okay, I'll hold it. Just to show you what this is like, for an isolated pulsar, so typically we do Fourier transforms. In fact, I think I skipped that slide. I'm just going to go back for a second. Yeah. So we de-disperse at many trial dispersion measures. And for each trial dispersion measure, we do a fast Fourier transform. We do what I'm about to describe, an acceleration search. And we do some other tricks to try and bring out the signals. We also now have been implementing, in the last decade, very much so single pulse searches, because I mentioned to you that there's these rotating radio transients that only like to spit out one pulse that are not going to be detected in a Fourier transform. So we also look for single pulses. And all of this is a high-performance computing project. Yeah, so for an isolated pulsar, it's basically a spike in Fourier space. And you can see here the normalized power is at 1. But if you have a pulsar in a binary, and this is a 3-millisecond pulsar in a binary, in this binary, which I think is a one-day binary. So the orbital period is 1 day, which is much, you know, we know orbital periods that are 2.5 hours. So 1 day binary with a 2-hour observation, you can see that the power in Fourier space is spread over many Fourier bins, and you see the amplitude now 2% of what it was if it had been isolated. So this is a huge effect, and this is why we have to also search in acceleration space, that is, assuming that the change in period is due to a linear acceleration, which of course for an eccentric binary isn't always going to be true. So we have a loss because of that. And then you get your candidate pulsars. So this is a candidate that you might think is really weak, but no, that's a real pulsar. And I you know, I'm sure we've confirmed this one. This is a plot showing, for example, the phase as a function of time in the observation. This is the phase as a function of frequency, and you can see it's broadband here. This is after dedispersion. And this is the signal to noise, or in the case of reduced chi-squared, as a function of dispersion measure where it peaks up nicely. You expect that for a real pulsar. Many interference doesn't do that. And then there's other little diagnostics that we use. So we typically look at lots and lots of these plots. And is it real? Is it not real? And this is now our single pulse pipeline. I put this up actually for Kendrick's sake. This is from the P-alpha survey. What we plot now, here's time on this axis and dispersion measure on this axis. And you can see there's a repeating source at roughly the same dispersion measure. Each point here is one event, but I'm just showing you the significant, lots of events. And you can also see wavy baselines and all sorts of things. So you're trying to find these pulses in what can be typically some pretty horrible noise. Highly non-Gaussian statistics are hard. OK, so searching for new millisecond pulsars, these are the two surveys that we're doing. One is with the Arecibo telescope, which is the largest radio telescope in the world in Puerto Rico. Using a frequency of 1.4 gigahertz. This is the P-alpha survey, which is the Pulsar Arecibo L-band feed array survey. So what's actually is a receiver that has six different antennas at the same time. So you're actually looking at six different spots on the sky simultaneously. Because these telescopes are radio telescopes, they're diffraction limited. The beams are pretty small on the sky. And so if you want to survey large areas, having a feed array, having a multi-beam, a seven-beam receiver is really useful because you can survey seven times as fast. So we have 300 megahertz of bandwidth at 1.4 gigahertz, and we're surveying the galactic plane. So the Arecibo telescope field of view is so tiny, surveying the whole sky is hopeless, particularly at this high radio frequency, 1.4 gigahertz, which we choose in order to minimize the effects of dispersion. So we're searching in the longitude range available to Arecibo in the galactic latitudes of 5 degrees. In total, we're going to collect about a petabyte of data with that survey and spend hundreds of core years processing it. And also the Green Bank North Celestial Cap Survey using the 100-meter Green Bank telescope. We're surveying the full GBT visible sky. This is at a much lower frequency, 350 megahertz, and a bandwidth of 100 megahertz, 0.4 petabytes, but much more computationally intensive because of the effects of dispersion at the lower frequencies mean more computing power. We're doing all of this processing at a supercomputer that's operated by McGill University and Calcul Quebec and Compute Canada. And I'll just show you some of the interesting discoveries from these surveys. The P-alpha survey, you can see here, the black dots are previously known pulsars. The blue ones are P-alpha discoveries. Now looking down, and this is, you can see now, the only regions of the galactic plane that Arecibo can actually see, because Arecibo cannot point anywhere in the sky. It's fixed to declinations between 0 and plus 40. So that's the region of the galactic plane Arecibo can see. And you see we're finding pulsars way far out in the galaxy. If you look at P-alpha discoveries, this is now spin period and dispersion measure on the y-axis. What you see is that for the millisecond pulsars, we're finding really short period pulsars, but at considerably higher dispersion measures than has been found before. So we're opening up a region of the galaxy thanks to the high frequency that minimizes the effects of dispersion. We're opening up a larger volume of the galaxy that has been possible before and finding lots of millisecond pulsars that way. One of the first millisecond pulsars we found was really confusing to us because I told you that most millisecond pulsars, particularly the fastest pulsars, which have had a long time to recycle to be recycled, that is to get angular momentum from a binary companion, should be in circular orbits. I told you this at the start, and we found a 2-millisecond pulsar in an eccentricity 0.4 orbit with a 1 solar mass non-degenerate companion. So it's not a white dwarf. We can actually detect the companion in this case. You know, it looks like a solar type star, and it's very hard to understand where this, how this object was formed. Something particularly interesting about it, and it's really bright, by the way, there you could see it, there's the discovery plot. One thing that we have been able to do is, because you can see the companion, is you can measure from its absorption lines in its spectrum, you can measure its radial velocity. So you know the radial velocity of the system. And we can also measure the transverse velocity from the pulsar, which in ways I could describe, but we can do both. And we can measure the 3D velocity of the system, which is very unusual for pulsars. You have to have some way of measuring the radial velocity, and we don't. And so what Paulo Freire and the rest of our team have shown is that if you integrate that velocity in the galactic potential, this pulsar has to have been born and lived its whole life in the galactic plane. And this is a millisecond pulsar. That's not the standard lore for millisecond pulsars. You don't find them only in the plane. They're billions of years old. They should have drifted out of the plane. Somehow this has stayed in the plane. It's formed this way. We don't really understand the formation mechanism, but the best guess right now is that it formed in a triple system where the recycling companion is now gone. And so you're seeing a former triple system where, for some reason, the object that recycled the pulsar has been kicked out. It's one hypothesis. I can refer you to his paper for details. But what's interesting is that we've been finding slowly more millisecond pulsars like this, a couple more that also seem stuck in the galactic plane. And so we think we may have found a new population of millisecond pulsars that likes to live only in the galactic plane. We've been finding,
can you go back for a second?
Yeah.
So this is orbit in the galaxy. So you, I guess the idea is that you know the velocity, and then you integrate back in time and see, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just the velocity is in the galactic plane.
Yes, okay. Yes, that's right. It has no velocity on the galactic plane. We've just recently found a second one of these eccentric millisecond pulsars, the paper's in preparation. And there's lots more that we've been finding very recently, and we hope to be subjecting them to these measurements of their velocities to see, is this really a new population of millisecond pulsars that P-alpha has uncovered thanks to its really sensitive survey in the galactic plane. The other discovery that I want to highlight from P-alpha is the detection of radio transits, fast radio burst. So this is a new, as I mentioned at the start, a new exciting area where we've found, so basically these events are few millisecond radio bursts, but detected with dispersion measures that are much greater than anything the galactic models could produce. So I showed you the galactic model before, the picture with the spiral arms. For any line of sight, there's a maximum model predicted dispersion measure. But what we've been finding are radio bursts, single radio bursts, where the dispersion measure, and here's an example, and you can see here a similar plot to what I showed you before. This is time. And this is radio frequency going from 1,200 to 1,500 megahertz. This is about 1.4 seconds long, so 1,400 milliseconds. You can see this burst zip through the band with a perfect frequency to the minus 2 cold plasma dispersion law, like perfect as far as we can measure. It's like 1% precision. But with a dispersion measure that's much higher than what the galaxy can produce. And a handful of these have been previously, one was detected in 2007, this famous Lorimer burst. Thornton et al. In 2013 came out with four more of them at the Parkes telescope. We found the first non-Parkes FRB, and I'll show you in a second here. There it is, observed by Spittler et al. In 2014. So You know, you might have heard that some of these objects were produced at parks, or at least some of them had very peculiar properties and seemed to be clustered around lunchtime. And it turned out that some of the original parks events were actually produced by interference from a local microwave oven that was opened while it was still in operation. So if the microwave oven was off and you opened it, it didn't matter, it didn't affect it. But the microwave oven, if it was still in operation, somebody opened it prematurely, it let out a burst of waves, that radio waves, that were dispersed with not exactly the cold plasma dispersion law, but surprisingly close to it. And if you ask, why would a microwave oven do this? Nobody knows, but it was definitely reproduced and verified. However, so but the key point here is that that was just a small fraction of the original events that they observed. All of the ones from microwave ovens were very clearly different from the pack, clustered at lunchtime, and most importantly, detected in every beam of their receiver. They have at parks, they have 13 beams. Okay, so when it was a microwave oven, every receiver saw it. When it's on the sky, only one receiver sees it, or maybe two sometimes if it arrives between the two beams. So,
a farther microwave oven,
yeah. So all of this has been discussed in great depth. I think
the restaurant's at the end of the universe.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, I spent a full afternoon with Svi Paran, I don't know if it's Svi Paran at Hebrew University, talking about, are there microwave ovens in airplanes? And could the flight attendants be opening them? And it turns out airliners don't typically, they have different type of ovens. But private jets do. Anyway, the point is, so you could discuss this ad infinitum. But the point is, you have to by them only being detected in a single beam. That proves they have to be beyond a certain distance. The Parkes telescope is about 40 kilometers. The Arecibo, it's hundreds of kilometers. There's no way this can be from a terrestrial phenomenon. And as I'm about to explain, well, okay, I'll tell you something else that disprove. You know. Anyway, that was all at Parkes. We found one now at Arecibo. There's also one published in Nature last week from the Green Bank telescopes. It's an astrophysical phenomenon. And what's really shocking is the estimated rate. So these telescopes have very, very small fields of view, but given the amount of time that they've spent on sky searching for pulsars, you can realize from extrapolating that the total event rate is about 3,000 per sky per day. So you might have heard about the gamma ray burst phenomenon. That's about one burst per sky per day. This is a very huge, very large event rate, and we don't know what the origin is, except that it's got to be extragalactic. And I'll just say one exciting result from P-alpha that we've just found is in follow-up observations of the first non-Parkes FRB, it repeats. So this is a paper that will be coming out shortly in Nature. Neuspittler et al. Results. We have 10 additional bursts from the source. The first one was detected in 2012. That's the original one that I've already shown you. This is now a whole bunch more in 2015. It's a very interesting source. It doesn't always burst.
How much of the time were you observing?
Yeah, so... we observed for many, I would say, something like 10 to 12 hours to detect these 10 bursts. But many of the observations were, they're typically 2 hours long and you wouldn't detect anything. And then one observation would come along and you see six within in a few minutes. So whatever it's doing, it's the bursts seem to be clustered. The dispersion measures are all consistent with each other to within a percent. So it's not something with the changing dispersion. It's very clearly the same dispersion measure. And the other clue that I don't have too much time to talk about these, but is just notice the hugely variable spectra. So this is, again, it's always radio frequency going up, and you see this one is really bright in the lower half of the band, and then these two are like 10 seconds apart. This one is really bright in the upper half. You know, so radio sources in astronomy don't do that. That's very rare. I can only think of maybe one analog, which might be in some ways, but in some ways not, the crab pulsars, giant pulses.
Did you check if there is also signal at other frequencies? Or
right. So we did get time at the Green Bank Telescope, and we now have detected it at 2 gigahertz, 2 to 2.2 gigahertz. We have looked for it at 800 megahertz and not yet detected it, but in that case, we only got 7.5 hours, so maybe it just didn't feel like bursting at that time.
Can you check much higher than gamma rays?
We got director's discretionary time on Swift telescope, on Chandra. During those observations, we didn't detect anything, but there are sources in the error box. Remember, it's still... the error region here is still fairly large, so that's one of the problems with single-dish radio telescopes. Like I said, the beam is diffraction limited, so the uncertainty here is about 2 arc minutes, 1 to 2 arc minutes. So yes, we see a source, an X-ray source in the field, but the chance probability of seeing some random X-ray source in the field is non-zero. So we're doing lots of follow-up observations. We've done one set of optical observations and not taken anything.
And you're hoping that these are extragalactic.
Right. So I will say to you, yes. And it's a very fair question to ask, and we've searched our souls deeply to understand how they could possibly be galactic. And since you ask, I've been actually thinking about this a lot.
Yeah.
You could say, well, what if there's some cloud of electrons between us, an H2 region? Those are very common in the galaxy. Why couldn't there be an H2 region along the line of sight? Fortuitous lining up, it's possible. But you can ask, what size H2 region? Because you know roughly how much extra dispersion you need in order to get it. You have to say, what size H2 region? And then if you have a cloud of electrons from thermal Bremsstrahlung, you expect both absorption and emission. And also from recombination, you expect H-alpha emission. And so then you can go to MAPS and you can look, is there any evidence? Well, first of all, from these, is there any evidence of absorption? And I would argue clearly this is optically thin in the sense that you see the spectrum very hugely. Like it's very hard to understand. It has to be optically thin. So that already places a lower limit on the size of the nebula. It can't be too small. Otherwise, you'd have absorption of the radio waves. Then
could it be done locally in the region where the pulse is emitted, the very dense region?
Well, you would still have these. So the argument I'm giving, if it's optically thin, then you absolutely have a lower size limit, and it can't be lower size of the dispersing cloud. So one of the sorts of questions that a galactic observer like me asks: well, could galaxies, they have dark matter halos? Could they have electron halos too? And maybe this is at 30 kiloparsecs, but not cosmological distances. So I've been told by people who know, who studied, for example, quasar absorption lines and things like that, that the maximal sort of galactic halo of electrons could contribute maybe 30 or 50 in electron density. The dispersion measure here is 557. The maximum along the line of sight from our models is about 180, 190. So you're still more than double whatever could be plausible from inside the galaxy. Very hard to understand how it could be galactic. I've totally run out of time. So I'm going to skip. I'll just say this. We're doing great science with the GBT. We're doing a wonderful 350 megahertz survey where we found a disappearing millisecond pulsar, disappeared from the sky. Don't know if it's going to return. If you're curious, ask me about it after. And I'm sorry to also have to skip this great, second most relativistic binary yet discovered, a millisecond pulsar in a 40 millisecond pulsar in a 2.4 hour orbit, where we can also measure the companion's velocity curve. I don't have time to talk about it, unfortunately. I'll just say this, it's also 2 solar masses, so it's the most relative, it's a 2.4 hour relativistic binary with a massive neutron star, and GR works. So it's good news for gravitational waves. It basically, I don't have time, because I want to talk about Chime. So sorry, we have lots more millisecond pulsars. Each one tells us a different story. I'm trying to tell you why it's so important to search for pulsars, You find all sorts of cool things. And we know the population is, you know, we're seeing so far maybe 10% of the galaxy's population. Okay, so I'm going to take 2 extra minutes to tell you about this wonderful radio telescope. I can talk arbitrarily quickly. And so, this is the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, going to be in Penticton, British Columbia. 4 cylindrical paraboloids, that's a person, 80 by 20 meters, so this is very large. Transit telescope, no moving parts. The total collecting area is comparable to the GBT. Put that on for American audiences. The way this works is that there's 256 receivers hung from each of these axes. Dual polarization receivers that are sensitive in a very wide bandwidth, that's a fractional bandwidth of 50%, from 400 to 800 megahertz. That's really powerful. And dual polarization says a total of 2048 input signals. And this has been already funded by for $12 million by the Canada Foundation for Innovation. How does a telescope like this work if you have just one of these receivers hanging? Well, the focusing is all in the east-west direction when this is oriented north-south, and so the beam on the sky is very, very broad in the north-south direction. If you put many of them along an axis and you Fourier transform, you get this series of beams along the north-south direction. And then if you consider all of these and you Fourier transform in both directions, then you get all of those beams, a total of 1024 beams for the full 4-cylinder time telescope. This was planned and designed for cosmology purposes, for observing H1 in the distant universe. 400 to 800 megahertz was chosen for redshifted H1 in the redshift range 0.8 to 2.5. And the idea is to measure baryon acoustic oscillations, that is, remnants from the acoustic oscillations in the very early universe, but redshifted to look for looking for the effect in H1. And the idea is it's sort of a cosmic standard ruler, and to see the size of those signals, the size of those features evolving with redshift, and that can give you superfluous rays and dark energy. And that's all great. This is the Time Cosmology Collaboration. You see Kendrick Smith, who's involved here at Perimeter. July 23rd, the structure's there. That's the cosmology team in the feed axis. In Nature, half pipe array to map teen universe. But that's not all. Time is very sensitive to pulsars, so you could do wonderful pulsar studies with time. You have large area, wide bandwidth. We can detect every pulsar in the northern sky, and we received NSERC funding to build a pulsar back end so we can observe 10 of these beams 24/7. And we're going to do daily observations of some of these binary systems, all sorts of wonderful pulsar astronomy to do. Never mind. We can detect them all. They're really bright. But fast radio bursts, CHIME can be an excellent fast radio burst detector. This is why I think a lot of us are very excited also about CHIME. This is a plot showing you the detection abilities of the various different radio telescopes that are implementing fast radio burst real-time detectors. This is burst per hour versus observing wavelength. And so you want to be as far to the right on this side of the plot, because that's detecting more bursts per hour. And so you can see, for example, Parkes has to observe a very long time. They have a very small field of view, P alpha, similar. And CHIME will beat them all. I mean, by orders of magnitude, CHIME will do extremely well in this regard. So most radio bursts are detected at wavelength around 21 centimeters. We're lower in frequency, which actually, it could be useful or it could be not useful. So we're very glad there's been one detection at 800 megahertz using the GBT, so we know fast radio bursts do emit down there. And so we're very excited by this. This is the CHIME FRB collaboration. In addition to the CHIME cosmology team, we have these various people, including students and postdocs at McGill, Ingrid Stairs, Scott Ransom, Paul Demarest, and Brian Gainsler. We've been funded now. In order to do this, you have to change things in time significantly. The correlator that was going to combine all of the signals from the different feeds, which originally would have been, you know, it will be the most powerful correlator on the planet, but also there was no need for fast time resolution, you know, for looking at baryon acoustic oscillations. You don't need millisecond cadence. So there has to be that, and for better frequency resolution that we really need, there has to be significant changes to the correlator. But we have got funding for that and for an FRB backend to detect FRBs in real time and signal, provide alerts to the worldwide astronomical community. We got CFI funding for that. We're currently designing things. And exactly the event rate will depend on things, the constraints of the design. There's a maximum power usage allowed on site because you want lots of computers to do this. We're restricted by that. So we want to minimize power consumption while maximizing sky coverage. And that's what we're trying to figure out now. So what do we want from time? We want thousands of events. We would like to have thousands of these events. We think, we can detect a dozen or two per day. In contrast to the small handful, they only, it's only 16 published so far since 2007. We will be able to look for distribution on the sky, distribution in DM, flux distribution, luminosity functions. Chime can do all this. We can detect or rule out repetition in every FRB. With Arecibo, it's easy to detect repetition, perhaps, because we're so sensitive. Maybe all the others are repeating, but you just can't detect the repetition. We'll have daily observations of all of these sources. We can do it in all in real time so that if there are counterparts at the same time, we can send X-ray and optical telescopes looking at them, and we should have sensitivity to polarization. So conclusions. Pulsar surveys are important for many reasons. PIALF and GBT surveys have been very fruitful. And we're finding eccentric pulsars, different tests of general relativity with binary pulsars. I had to skip one really interesting one. But anyway, there's lots more to come. We're hoping to find sub-millisecond pulsars, pulsar black hole binaries. And time is going to be really useful for pulsars and for fast radio bursts. So thank you very much.
Maybe just a couple of questions for everybody.
Yeah, sorry, I went over.
If you had to give your best guess for what these FRBs are, what would you say?
Well, if you had asked me 2 days ago, I would have said my best guess is some form of neutron star. I mean, you need something that could produce a really short timescale event. And some of them, I haven't told you this, but some are observed to be highly linearly polarized. And something that can repeat. And so it says it smells like compact object. The emission has to be coherent, so it smells like a magnetic field. So what has, it's really compact, has a magnetic field and can produce emission? Well, neutron stars. The repeating one certainly supports that. On the other hand, we just had this great colloquium yesterday from Vikram Ravi at Caltech, who convinced me they're cosmic strings. So I don't understand the physics of cosmic strings well enough to be able to say whether or not they're likely to produce short bursts of radio emission. Maybe some of you can inform me about that. But I think the first question we really have to answer is, how nearby are they? Are they at cosmological distances, or are they just a few hundred megaparsecs? I don't think they're galactic, but it's not impossible that they're just in fairly nearby galaxies. And so the energy scale would change totally. The environments really matter. So what we really have to do is localize them. That's the key. That's the key. Localizing them, deciding, is it in young galaxies, is it old galaxies? Exactly how you do it, it's not so simple. So my best guess, I don't want to put a guess. Like, I'm a scientist, but so I don't know.
Would you be able to get that information in the near future?
Yeah, so if they have, so there's a few different avenues you could do it. One is you have a repeating one, that's really helpful. You can propose for interferometer time. And in fact, even as we speak, I think we're on the European VLBI network observing, and we should be actually simultaneously observing with Swift. And so if the thing goes off and produces a burst that's bright enough to be seen, we'll have an instant localization in radio. Or if it produces X-ray bursts, then we will have an arc second localization with Swift. So those are avenues. You know, with CHIME, it's an interferometer, but still the angular resolution is not so good. So you need a counterpart. The other way that people are trying to localize it, and there's another result about to come out in Nature where they're claiming a localization, is by detecting it in real time and then quickly going to an interferometer and looking for a fading radio source after, as if burst perhaps released emission that is leaving some sort of afterglow. And the Parks group has claimed to detect a FRB, and then a couple days, well, I don't know if it's within hours, I haven't seen the paper, but within hours to days, they got onto the Australian Compact Array and detected a fading radio source. But then the question becomes, given the large error region of the original FRB, how do you know that that fading radio source is associated with the FRB? There are variable radio sources in the sky, and in fact, the level of variability, how many variable sources per square degree, what's the likelihood of that chance alignment, is, you know, I have to read their paper for them to convince me that it's not just luck.
But they are claiming it looks like a correlation.
They are claiming it, yes. Yes, I will say we did, well, we did target of opportunity observations with the VLA of our repeating FRB, and we found a fading transient radio source outside the error box of our FRB. So what that says to you is we either got incredibly lucky or they're not as unlikely as you might think. So I have to see their paper before I comment, but the answer is there's many potential avenues for localizing them, but we're not there yet.
Your slide on the eccentric millisecond pulsars, one of the bullet points is that it could be a selection effect.
Oh,
possibly.
Well, what I meant there is that what I meant is that in that eccentric system, it seems confined to the plane. And so that's one of the, so A, the mysteries are, I'll never find it. The mysteries are that it's eccentric, that it has a non-degenerate companion, and that it's confined in the plane. And so when I say by selection effect, I mean the P alpha survey is very sensitive exclusively in the galactic plane. So you're only ever going to find things in the galactic plane. So who knows if the system, you know, if the weird binary properties have to do with it being in the plane or not. But if, as we continue to search, we find more and more such eccentric systems, and none of the all-sky surveys do, then we'll know that the two properties are definitely correlated. And the evolutionary history has to do, you know, you have to explain it somehow, having to stay in the plane.
Great. If there are no more questions, let's thank Vicky again for a very fascinating talk.